And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. There's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper happy. And let's get right on into our commentary here. This is a letter from George Werthener. It's to the Defenders of Wildlife. Let's get right into it. Dear Defenders, I beg you to take a moment to reflect upon where your policies, particularly regarding wolf restoration, are taking wildlife. The latest outrage is the agreement to participate in wolf aversive conditioning. It's another example of the inability to take a long-term perspective on wildlife issues. Where is the wild? I'm not just being rhetorical. This is a very important question. Aversive conditioning requires manipulation of the wild in wolves. If manipulation is the only way that wolves can survive in today's world, then it's time to change our world, not go further down the technological manipulative path that is destroying the wild and life with it. Aversive conditioning is only necessary because the livestock industry refuses to take responsibility for preventing predation opportunities. Why doesn't Defenders continuously bring this to the attention of the public? Aversive conditioning, shock collars, and all the rest is treating wolves as if they were some kind of object, as if they have no relationship to the rest of the landscape and other animals. It's the same kind of thinking that killed off the wolf and wildness in the first place. Aversive conditioning is a techno-solution like fish hatcheries were used as a way to avoid dealing with the habitat degradation of river systems. Instead of addressing the habitat problems created by the livestock industry, Defenders has chosen to advocate more technological solutions. It's the same failed policy that has driven the salmon to near extinction. Don't you people learn from the past? Why are you following the same failed strategies? Sure, maybe we'll have a few wolves running around with shock collars on them, but is this really a solution? There is a tremendous danger to such a strategy. Soon ranchers and their political lackeys in Congress will be demanding that we build an electrical field fence around Yellowstone and collar all wolves so that they are shocked when they hit the fence. Will you object to this and go along so we can continue to deceive ourselves into thinking that wolf recovery is a success? Can you rationalize that Sheep Mountain Pack would have been killed, so treating them with shock collars is better? But you should have been loudly protesting the circumstances that made them stock killers in the first place. Putting cows out in the middle of a Forest Service allotment with wolves, leaving dead cows around the landscape, and having no guard dogs or herders is what doomed this pack from the start. Why isn't Defenders making this the issue? We shouldn't be putting any energy into changing wolf behavior. We need to change human behavior, particularly those humans involved in the livestock industry. The only way you will change human behavior is by rallying the hundreds of thousands of your supporters to protest loudly and repeatedly every time ranchers create predator opportunities and every time the Fish and Wildlife Service refuses to protect wolves from the livestock industry. Shock collars and other programs are opening up a Pandora's box down a path I don't want to see us go, and I think that if you considered it, you would agree as well that this is a wrong path to follow. If aversive conditioning has proven successful, the livestock industry will soon demand that all wolves be treated. Is this what you want? I hope not. Ultimately, if we are to restore wolves across the landscape, wolf advocates are going to have to bite the bullet and challenge the livestock industry's hegemony over the West. Better to do it now than wait. It would be easier to accept shock collars and other measures if Defenders were at the same time trying to change expectations about rancher behavior, but I see none of that. Indeed, your statements and your policies all reinforce the perception that wolves are a burden and ranchers have a legitimate right to a predator-free environment. Why is it so difficult to defend the rights of wildlife to live freely? Why isn't Defenders selling the message that every cow on public lands is a threat to wolves and bison and grizzlies and sage grouse and cutthroat trout, etc.? That every hamburger costs us riparian zones, polluted waters, dead wolves, and so forth. This is the kind of message that a group with the name Defenders of Wildlife should be making. You may feel that I am a radical or a hopeless idealist, but shouldn't we be aiming for an ideal? Shouldn't that be the goal? Yes, we might have to accept compromises, but they shouldn't be the ones creating them. As a group that has made wolves your major conservation theme and fundraising tool, I believe you have reneged on your responsibility to the wolves and to all wildlife. I hope you will reconsider your current strategy and position and begin to take a more proactive position that will ultimately restore wild wolves and preserve the wild in nature. Short-term gains of a few token wolves in Yellowstone or central Idaho aren't worth losing the wild from our land. This is a editorial open letter to the Defenders of Wildlife from George Werthener. If you'd like to contact George, his email address is Werthener, W-U-E-R-T-H-N-E, at teleport.com. That's W-U-R-T-H-N-E at teleport.com. Speaking of wildlife, let's get into some wildlife news here. From Brownsville, Texas, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says a record number of nests of the endangered Kemp's Ridley sea turtles have been found on Mexico's Gulf Coast south of Brownsville. About 5,250 nests have been protected so far this year. The current number already exceeds the 3,875 nests protected during the entire 1999 nesting season. By the close of the nesting season in August, actual nesting adults in Mexico may exceed 6,000. This modern-day record is providing biologists with the hope that the Kemp's Ridley sea turtle is continuing to recover from the brink of extinction. Quote, this is a testament to the species' tenacity and longevity, unquote, said Nancy Kaufman, regional director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Southwest Region, and it is also a testament to the cooperative willpower of two nations with support from nearby residents and a variety of other partners. Protection afforded the species by our governments combined with increased research, monitoring, and educational efforts is starting to show significant results, said Dr. Rene Marquez, National Sea Turtle Coordinator for the Instituto Nacional de la Pesca in Mexico. We are finally starting to see the fruits of our labor. In 1947, 40,000 female Kemp's Ridley sea turtles came ashore to nest, with anywhere between 80 and 140 eggs laid in each nest. There was no indication that the species was in danger of becoming extinct, but by the late 1970s, single nestings rarely exceeded 200 females. The species was almost decimated because of human encroachment, including poaching for eggs and meat, disease epidemics, predation of eggs by crabs, birds, and fish, and unmanaged fishing practices. The turtle was listed as endangered throughout its range in 1970. Biologists have a goal of ensuring a nesting population of 10,000 turtles per year before upgrading the status of the species to merely threatened. And in news this week, an intense underwater noise or explosive pressure has led to the strandings of five beaked whales in the Bahamas in March, federal marine biologists have revealed. The strandings occurred while the United States Navy was conducting tests of a powerful sonar system. A panel of biologists hired by the National Marine Fisheries Service reported on autopsies performed on four Cuvier's beaked whales, one Blainesville's dense beaked whale, and a spotted dolphin. Though the dolphin was found to have died of a long-standing infection, the whales all showed evidence of severe trauma to their ears and other areas. The injuries to the beaked whales are, quote, all consistent with an intense acoustic or pressure event, the report states. The injuries were revealed in the necropsies were not consistent with a nearby explosion because there were no bone fractures, but it could have been caused by a distant explosion or an intense acoustic event. During a telephone press conference, Darlene Ketten, a marine biologist at Harvard Medical School and the Woods Hole of Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts, said the findings were the first to link a distant noise or explosion with whale strandings. Ketten, an expert on whale acoustics, said, quote, the coincidence of the timing and the pattern of the stranding with the presence of the Navy sonars raises a red flag, and I think that there's a reason for concern. But she warned that the findings did not conclusively link the Navy tests with the strandings. Quote, I'm still not ready to say that the Navy did that, said Ketten. The Navy has promised to devote more money and resources to researching the effects of its activities on beaked whales. Very little is known about these deep sea critters. But in a letter to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Robert Peary Jr., wrote that the Navy recognized the Bahamas stranding as, quote, an unusual and significant event, and, quote, and that the Navy is cooperating in the ongoing investigation of the whale deaths. On May 26, the Navy canceled planned tests of its Littoral Warfare Advanced Development System scheduled to begin off the east coast of the United States. Environmentalists blame low-frequency sonar tests and underwater explosions for a wave of recent marine mammal strandings. In 1996, 12 beaked whales stranded in Greece during NATO exercises in the Mediterranean Sea using low-frequency sonar. During other Navy exercises, this is a goosebeak whale stranded off Vieques, Puerto Rico in January 1998, five goosebeaks stranded alive in Acadia off Puerto Rico's northwest coast in July of 1998, and four stranded alive in St. Thomas, St. John, and St. Croix in October 1999. On March 15th and 16th of this year, at least 16 marine mammals representing at least four species stranded at several locations in the northern Bahama Islands over a 36-hour period. Seven of the animals died, while the others were pushed off and returned to the sea. And a spring survey that has tallied 2,317 California sea otters, a 10.9% increase over last year. This is the first overall increase observed since the spring of 1995, when the threatened population reached its highest number of 2,317. 177 individuals. A breakdown of the 2000 survey shows a 13.8% increase in pups since the spring of 1999 and a 10.5% increase in adults and subadults. The survey, conducted by scientists of the U.S. Geological Survey, the California Department of Fish and Game, Monterey Bay Aquarium, and with the help of experienced volunteers, covered about 375 miles of California coast from Half Moon Bay south to Santa Barbara. The information gathered will be used by federal and state wildlife agencies in making decisions about the management of this sea mammal. Quote, while we are encouraged by the larger numbers, it is too soon to know if this signifies a true increase in population size, says USGS scientist Dr. James Estes. Quote, wildlife surveys are inherently imprecise, and this is not the first time we have obtained counts that departed substantially from existing trends. Therefore, the sustained trend over the next several years will be required before we can say with any confidence that the period of decline is over. A low population growth rate has slowed the recovery of the California sea otter. The Central California population increased this century at an average annual rate of about 5% until the 1970s, when the growth rate ceased and the population began to decline. After a rebound, the otter's numbers again began to decline in 1995. Disease, contaminants, starvation, and entanglement or entrapment in coastal fishing gear may have contributed to the recent sea otter decline, Estes said. And a federal judge has ruled that Washington State can proceed with the proposed slaughter of up to 3,500 Canadian geese in the Seattle area. The state will use carbon dioxide gas to suffocate the geese. State officials had sought federal approval for a kill in a 12-county region around Puget Sound, saying increased geese populations in the area were fouling waterways, parks, and residential areas with their droppings. A single goose can produce 3 pounds of shit each day. The region's goose population has been growing by about 14% a year to a current level of 25,000 birds. Patricia Lane, a wildlife attorney for the Humane Society of the United States, argued during hearings that the federal permit allowing officials to stage the kill should be scrapped because it violated provisions of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. The Humane Society of the United States contended the permit was based on insufficient data that did not satisfy the government's own regulations. She also asserted that the approval process was tainted because the government did not specify killing sites, denying the public a chance to suggest alternatives, a violation of the National Environmental Policy Act. But U.S. District Judge Marsha Peckman lifted a temporary injunction, saying the Humane Society of the United States and other animal rights groups were unlikely to win their case in a trial. Peckman ruled in favor of state officials who said droppings pose a public health risk. Obviously, we are extremely disappointed at Judge Peckman's ruling, said Lane. Quote, but we are more disappointed that federal and state officials have decided to go ahead with a slaughter that is not only inhumane but will prove ineffective as well. Killing the geese will have little long-term effect on the goose population, but it sets a tragic and terrible precedent. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is investigating a massive slaughter of nesting double-crested cormorants at the Little Charity Island on Saginaw Bay in Michigan. The remains of more than 500 nesting birds, about half the breeding population on the island, were discovered by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologists on May 30th. The cormorants are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and a criminal investigation is now underway. Those responsible could have a $5,000 fine and or 6 months imprisonment. The birds were shot at their nesting sites, many while incubating eggs or brooding young. Dead birds littered the small 5.5-acre island, which is part of the Michigan Islands National Wildlife Refuge. Doesn't sound like much of a refuge to Uncle Dennis. Agents report that many of the birds appeared to be killed while sitting on their nests, while others were found dead on the ground. Other birds may have been wounded and died outside the immediate area. Young cormorants are unable to care for themselves until sometime in August, and many orphaned young birds also died. Double-crested cormorants, once common in all the Great Lakes, were devastated by the effects of toxic chemicals in the 1960s. That's DDT. Their numbers have rebounded since then to the point where some commercial fishermen see the birds as competitors. In April of 1999, 9 men from sport fishing communities around Lake Ontario pleaded guilty to charges stemming from the mass shotgun slaying of more than 1,000 double-crested cormorants on their nesting grounds at Little Galoo Island Bird Preserve on Lake Ontario. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is now developing a comprehensive cormorant management plan, which will address biological issues and impacts associated with cormorant populations. But anyone having information concerning the shootings at Little Charity Island should call the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Their number, 517-686-4578. That's 517-686-4578. Or the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Their number is 800-292-7800. That number again, 800-292-7800. And a federal appeals court recently overturned the ruling that allowed Washington State's Macaw Indians to resume whaling for the first time in more than 70 years. A panel of the 9th U.S. Court of Appeals ruled 2-1 that the environmental impact study had not been adequately considered. The case now goes back to federal court in Tacoma, Washington for additional proceedings, including a new environmental assessment to be done by the government. The Macaw had hunted whales for generations until the 1920s when commercial whaling decimated the whale populations, but the tribe moved to resume the hunt after gray whales were removed from the endangered species list in 1994. The Macaw, claiming whaling rights under the 1855 treaty, hunted and killed a gray whale in 1999. Indian whalers have been out this spring but have not been successful. The decision reinstates a lawsuit filed by Representative Jack Metcalf from Washington, sending it back to the before U.S. District Judge Franklin Burgess. Burgess had dismissed arguments from the congressman and animal rights groups that the environmental assessment for the hunt was inadequate. Biologists estimate 26,000 gray whales migrate each year between the waters off Alaska and Mexico, and tribal officials at Nea Bay, Washington, could not be reached for comment. And according to independent scientists, the Nevada Division of Wildlife is playing down the risk of extinction for the bull trout. A new review commissioned by Trout Unlimited says that the threatened bull trout faces a greater risk of extinction than the state will admit. Even allowing for the questionable sampling techniques used in the Nevada status report, the assessments all suggest a population at risk of extinction, explained one of the scientists. An independent review by the American Fisheries Society fuels the ongoing debate, with the Nevada Division of Wildlife and Elko County opposing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Forest Service over the status of bull trout populations in the state. Elk County continues to press the federal government to rebuild a washed-out road along bull trout habitat in the Humboldt National Forest in northeastern Nevada. The state and county claim that the fish population in the basin is stable and doesn't warrant protection under the Endangered Species Act. Trout Unlimited commissioned the report after the state refused to seek an independent review of its findings. And a 20th century warming trend appears to have reduced the growth of white spruce in some interior forests of Alaska, suggesting northern forests might not be as able as scientists thought to counteract global warming. Scientists trace global warmings to a buildup of carbon dioxide and other gases in the atmosphere, but they have reasoned that warmer temperatures would spur tree growth, which in turn would make the trees draw more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. The growth of inland Alaskan white spruce has declined, however, with warming temperatures. Researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks said in the journal Nature, that's the June 8th issue, the problem is that in this region, which is semi-arid, climbing temperatures have produced drought stress on the trees since the 1970s, they said. Their study used climate records and analysis of tree rings. White spruce is one of the most common trees in the northern forests of western North America. So the idea that warming will make those forests pull carbon dioxide from the atmosphere may be incorrect, and could lead scientists to underestimate future concentrations of the gas, according to the scientists. And the federal government has issued new rules to protect the West Coast salmon and steelhead trout, but even before they were made official, new regulations were criticized by environmentalists and property owners. The rules clarify restrictions on land and water use in order to protect 14 endangered species of fish. Previously, actions that might have harmed those fish were reviewed case by case. Property rights advocates say the rules go too far, but environmentalists say they are preparing to sue the National Marine Fisheries Service on grounds that the rules will not adequately protect endangered and threatened fish. The new rules announced by the Fisheries Service tell managers of public and private lands how to comply with the Endangered Species Act. The rules apply to 160,000 square miles of habitat across California, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. We'll look at those activities that clearly kill salmon, like bulldozers and streams with spawning salmon, and we'll look at other federal, state, or local conservation efforts to address more marginal activities that may nonetheless have cumulative effects on the listed fish and their habitats, said William Steele, head of the Northwest Regional Office of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. I'm having problems with that word today. The steelhead rules will be enacted in 60 days, but the rules for salmon will not become effective for 6 months. Based on its reading of a draft version of the rules released earlier, the Washington Environmental Council contends that the regulations are full of loopholes. The council has prepared a letter notifying the government of its intent to sue under the Endangered Species Act, said Becky Kelly, a council spokesperson. And there's a lot more old-growth forest left in North Carolina than previously believed, says a report issued by the Western North Carolina Alliance. The environmental group spent 4 years documenting more than 77,000 acres of old-growth forest scattered across the state's 1.1 million acres of national forests. About half of the areas documented contain trees that are more than 150 years old. The old-growth regions, which show no signs of ever having been logged, comprise 7.5% of the Pisgah and Nantahala National Forests. Most authorities assume that less than 1% of the state's remaining forests could be old-growth, the Western North Carolina Alliance said. The survey, entitled Old Growth Forest Communities in the Nantahala Pisgah National Forest, is the first systematic on-the-ground search for old trees in these forests. The Southern Appalachian Forest Coalition and the Sierra Club helped to pay for the work. Between 1994 and 1998, volunteers and paid consultants made more than 300 trips into 244 sites looking for old growth trees. Researchers counted tree rings and looked for signs of logging roads and cut stumps. They sorted old growth three categories: undisturbed, undisturbed by invasive species, and previously cut. Researchers found 17 old-growth sites of at least 1,000 acres each, a portion of the upper Catawba River Basin, including a 10,000-acre Linville Gorge Wilderness near Morgantown, had the densest concentration of old growth, with 38,000 acres. The survey discovered 19 trees that are more than 300 years old, including a 450-year-old white pine. Allowing the last vestiges of native forests in our region to continue to be fragmented, eroded, and logged would be similar to burning libraries and other important cultural artifacts, the report concluded. We're pleased to bring you the results of the investigation launched by the Citizens Against Government Waste, a 600,000-member private, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to educating Americans about our waste mismanagement and inefficiency in the federal government. And here is the report. This one's on the Mi'kmaq whaling issue. Whether you are Trevier, the leader of the musical Fiddler on the Roof, or a member of the American Indian tribe trying to resurrect a long-forgotten hunting custom, you have to know that some traditions just aren't worth keeping, especially if they cost taxpayers $5 million. While cutting back on normal operations, such as ticketing drunken boaters and arresting drug smugglers due to increased oil prices, the Coast Guard is spending $11,550 an hour to help the Mi'kmaq Indian tribe of Washington resurrect a tradition. Ironically, Coast Guard spokesman John O'Dell has remarked, "If it is not a life-threatening situation, we will have to ask how much involvement from the Coast Guard there should be. Apparently, the rules change if the Clinton-Gore administration wants something." In Nia Bay, Washington, the federal government has doled out almost $5 million to help the Mi'kmaq tribe resurrect their tradition of hunting gray whales. The Mi'kmaq tribe hunt is not a tradition at all. Unlike 21st century Mi'kmaq, earlier Mi'kmaq did not wear Nikes and Adidas and use automatic rifles on their hunts. The earlier tribesmen certainly did not get government funding for their hunting. Their sense of pride came from conducting the hunt themselves. The amount of money that we've spent so the Mi'kmaq can go whaling. Let's run it down here. $300,000 for a grant to prepare for the hunt. $435,000 for a grant to teach the tribe how to eat whale meat. $335,000 from the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration and the National Marine Fisheries Service to ensure that domestic and international whaling laws were followed. $87,000 directly from the Bureau of Indian Affairs for the hunt. $13,910 from the U.S. Marshal's Office for Operation Harpoon. And that doesn't count the government's spending spree of almost $1 million. $751,295 was spent for the National Guard and FBI to monitor anti-whalers at the 1998 Mi'kmaq Days celebration. Oh boy. $924,000 was used for Coast Guard escorts for the spring of 2000 hunt. The government spent $44,800 on legal fees. We've just about run out of time for Earth First News tonight. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio. We're at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you'd like more in-depth news on information about the Earth First Movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440, or that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. You can listen to Earth First Radio on your computer a couple of ways. We are live streaming at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. Or if you want to listen to us later, tune in to the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. As always, my name is Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. Now we're going to listen to some music by Robert Hoyt from his Dumpster Diving Across America, and this one's called Quitting Time.
Most were made with the best of intentions. Thought it was cool to put a man on the moon, but now I've begun to sing a different tune. Technology and science have become a religion based on blind faith, not conscious decision. When answers cause the problems, it's time to stop and think. Slam on the brakes and make a U-turn from the brink. It's quitting time. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that high-tech plantation. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that old high-tech plantation. It's quitting time for good. They try to tell us how hard it used to be back when things tended towards simplicity, but our way of life is based on false pretenses. God's look at all the unintended consequences. It's quitting time, it's quitting time, it's quitting time on that high-tech plantation. It's quitting time, it's quitting time on that old high-tech plantation. It's quitting time for good. It's quitting time, it's quitting time, it's quitting time.